Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hello and welcome to The Election Tricycle, a show about the various elections going on in 2024, especially in our three countries, the United States, India and the UK. I'm Tom Hamilton in London and I'm joined by Rohan Venkat, who is this week in Philadelphia, I believe.
Yes, hello.
And by Emily Tamkin, who is in Washington, D.C.
Yes, still in D.C.
And I want to remind you that if you want to sign up for the premium edition of this podcast, which has additional material, potted profiles, audience questions, whatever else we find to talk about that doesn't fit into the main bit of the show, you can sign up for that at tricycle.hubwave.net. So please do that. Before we get on to the main discussion of today, which is going to be about the fight against complacency by the leading candidates in our various elections, we want to start by just checking in with Rohan on the election that is already underway, where voting has started already, which is the Indian election, where I think the first round of voting has already taken place. Is that right, Rohan?
That's right, Tom. And yeah, for those just tuning in, India's elections take place over 7 phases. We have a previous episode on this, breaking down exactly how this works. But we had the first phase of voting on Friday, April 19th. And something curious happened after that first round of voting, which is that over the last few days, the tenor of the campaign coming out of the BJP, the party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, has turned a bit sharper. In particular, there was a speech by Prime Minister Modi a couple of days ago, after which he's being accused of hate speech. What he says at this speech is that the Congress party, the principal opposition party, is promising to take away the hard-earned money of you. And when he says you here, he is referring to the people at that rally, certainly, but broadly the people that the BJP speaks to, which is the Hindu vote bank that the BJP seeks to build. And what he says is that the Congress has in the past spoken of the fact that Muslims have the first right on resources in India, and that if the Congress were to come to power today, they would take all of your money, your hard-earned money and the gold that's held by the women of India and give it to them. He doesn't say who the them is, but he says infiltrators, ghuspetia, literally infiltrators, and those who have more children. Both of these, not even really dog whistles, just because he made the direct reference to Muslims earlier. It's about as sharp of a comment. Now, it's not new for Modi to use this kind of language, but he hadn't done it too much in the run-up to these elections, where the party was broadly exuding confidence. And just to do the little fact check before we discuss this further, the reference to what the Congress said is going back more than a decade to when Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who preceded Modi in the office, made a comment about equity and equality some time ago, pointing out that the state ought to ensure that those who have the first right on the resources are those who need it the most. He points out at the time, if I remember correctly, women, the poor, lower castes, and Muslims, and says in particular that the Muslims, according to numerous studies, are often the most backward according to number of indicators. The Congress has never said that Muslims, in a sense, have the first right on resources, but that's what he's referring to.
I can imagine that a UK politician who said this sort of thing, you wouldn't get a UK politician making a statement quite as blatant as that, but if they did, there would be a quite significant backlash. Presumably that's not the case in India, or if there is a backlash, they've judged it's still worth having.
It's a complex one because there both is a backlash in the sense that the opposition parties have become indignant about it and have gone to the Election Commission, which is supposed to regulate speech. In particular, India's code prevents the use of religion or the targeting of religion as a way of seeking votes. But as we've discussed before on this podcast, the referee institutions, including the Election Commission, are hardly acting as a check on the BJP. So on the one side, there is some outrage and backlash, but certainly a lot less today than it would have been 10 years ago, in part because this has been a key element of the BJP's playbook all along, particularly under Modi, to say that, you know, we're bringing everyone along with us. Sabka Saath, Sabka Vikas is one of Modi's key taglines. But at the same time, as needed and when they find important to do or convenient to do, to use much more direct language like this. Maybe the more interesting question is why this shift at this moment?
That is what I was going to ask. We have spoken on this podcast about how, though Modi and the BJP have used divisive rhetoric in the past, and quite, we can just call things by their own names, quite anti-Muslim rhetoric in the past, in this election, it had thus far been more muted. And we had spoken about why that might be. So why the shift now?
Yeah, I'll caveat with saying that for the first time in a long time, I'm not reporting in the field for this election. And there's a difference between Modi and the rest of the BJP. So while it's true it's a bit muted on the ground, you will find BJP leaders, not in the British sense, but politicians across the board using very sharp anti-Muslim speech on the ground in rallies. It's not necessarily something that has been more muted this time, but at the top level, it's more identifiable. We can track it from afar as well. And so Modi himself had certainly been a bit more muted. And maybe it speaks to what we're talking about a bit more broadly today. Modi went into the first phase of elections promising that BJP would get 370 seats and that his coalition would get 400 seats, you know, which would put them over 2/3 majority, give them the ability to change the constitution and so on. But with projecting that much confidence comes a level of complacency. And what we saw in the first phase is that there's been a turnout dip of nearly 5 percentage points. So where people had voted out at about 70% 5 years ago, numbers were down to 65% on average. In the first phase, 100 million people voted. This is bigger than, you know, most democratic countries. And so that's a significant dip. In some places, it's as much as less than, like, down by 10%. And the biggest number of seats, in a sense, of that list, which saw a drop, were seats that were won by the BJP 5 years ago. So there is talk. We rarely have a good glimpse into what the BJP is thinking because of how centralized it is. But there is a talk that some in the party are concerned that the projection of such confidence and winning 400 seats and so on has led to complacency and turnout, which, given a first-past-the-post system, could be tricky for them.
Well, that question about complacency is what we wanted to have our main discussion about, because we've got one election that, as you say, is already going on, where we have an overwhelming favourite who are trying not to be complacent. The election in my country, the UK, is one in which all the polls indicate that Labour are going to win. They might not win, but the polls have all been indicating that for a very long time. Emily, I guess you're in the country that has the least clear-cut in polling terms at the moment outcome. Either candidate could plausibly win at this point. But does that mean that it's very easy for everyone to avoid being complacent, or are people still behaving in ways that might not be as sensible as possible if you want to maximise your own side's turnout?
Well, no, I think that both candidates are still facing the challenge of complacency in a different sense, which is that because it felt so inevitable that these were going to be the two candidates, because there's really quite muted enthusiasm for both of them in different ways. Obviously, Trump has quite a rabid fan base, but is not popular more broadly. And obviously, Biden, as we've talked about on this podcast, is facing his own issues with enthusiasm and popularity. And you know, so I think both of them are trying to, in their own ways, convince voters not to be complacent. Trump is doing that by saying we have to take our country back and promising to remake the country in his own image. Biden is saying don't be complacent and stay home just because you're not excited about me. I'm running against Donald Trump. The other thing that, you know, and I'm sure we'll speak about this more as the election draws closer, the other part of this is how you vote, right? Election fraud or alleged fraud has been a big topic in the United States. One of the ways that Republicans have tried to hurt confidence in votes and voting is by attacking mail-in voting, so voting by mail. However, this was a real own goal in that traditionally Republicans who are maybe older who tend to be older really used mail-in voting. And so Republicans, in addition to complacency about a candidate, are now also facing complacency about a form of voting that was actually quite popular for them. Or not even complacency about hostility toward mail-in voting, really. And you see each time there were special elections on Long Island, and you saw the local politicians encouraging mail-in voting, and then the national politicians or the state politicians bashing it. So it's not quite the same, but I think there are still certain complacent mindsets that both parties are trying to cut through.
That's really interesting. From a campaigning point of view, parties tend to love mail-in voting, postal voting, as we call it in the UK, because you just get your vote in earlier. There are people whose doors you don't need to knock on the day because they've already voted. And so, although there've certainly been questions raised by different parties about the integrity of postal votes in the UK, I think overwhelmingly for people who are actually running campaigns, they just want as many of them as possible.
Yeah, of course. But this came up in 2020 when Trump went on and on and on about how fake votes and fraudulent votes and et cetera, and then lost Georgia. And there were Republicans in Georgia who were like, well, what did you think was going to happen? You told people not to use the voting system. So of course people stayed home. So now Republicans will do this thing where they're like, well, there's so much fraud that you have to get out in great force to overvote, to vote so much that the fraud is drowned out. So they're trying to cut through complacency in a different sense, right? Like Democrats are trying to get people not to be complacent about democracy and come out to vote. And I would say that by and large, the Republican Party line is to make people complacent about democracy because they are themselves the threat to democracy, but not be so complacent about the lies that they've told about democracy that they will not come out and vote.
It seems like a super tricky dance to do. And yet, I think, is it coming up as a very serious threat to their turnout, as you said, in Georgia? Because they've done a bunch of other things in order to attempt to restrict the other side from being able to vote as well.
Yes. We'll see how it has been an issue for them in 2020. And in 2022, in special elections, they've also faced this. And so we'll see. And this is just, I guess I'm just bringing this up as one example where attacking the elections that you're asking people to vote in turns out to not be the move. And it's a kind of complacency that the Republicans are facing. And again, I do think that they kind of face an enthusiasm gap as well in a way, because there are, again, this is not the Republican Party base, but there are people who maybe would have voted for Republican because they're tired of Biden or because they're tired of Democratic presidents or they're sick of Democrats or whatever. And the alternative is literally Donald Trump. So, and we should also say that, you know, I was actually reading a story yesterday about how Muslim and voting rights groups in the UK are worried because local elections are on May 2nd, and they're worried that voter ID laws that passed last year were not properly advertised, that people have not been properly informed, and that this will end up hurting voters of color and working class voters, and in London, especially Muslim voters. So this is not unique to the United States. And it's not even unique to Trump, but because Trump has expanded it to the elections are a lie, it's at a fever pitch here.
Do you think there's a decent chance that turnout in the US is going to be down just by virtue of the fact that, you know, not just the sort of voter suppression stuff, but the fact that both parties have candidates who may not have the level of enthusiasm that some presidential candidates of both parties in the past have had, that will lead to a lower turnout? Or is it just such an important election?
Yeah, if I had to guess today, I would say that yes, turnout will be lower than what you would think it would be given the stakes, but we will see. And also our last presidential election was during COVID. So it's hard to see exactly how things will change from 2020 to 2024, because 2020 was such a bizarre year.
I mean, COVID makes it even madder to be against postal voting.
No, well, but this is why he was against it, because he thought that many people were going to use postal voting and that thus, or mail-in voting, as we call it, and that thus, like, there was a big issue with Republicans in some states said that you could only start counting. This was the case in Pennsylvania, that you could only start counting the votes after Election Day. And then that was held up as evidence of fraud, because why weren't you able to count them before? And it's like, well, it's your party who passed this rule. Yeah, but I mean, they did it to diminish confidence in the election and in the outcome. And indeed, it didn't work in that they lost, but it did work in that there are still many people in this country who believe that the election was stolen from Trump.
How does this play out in the UK? I mean, is that something that the Labour Party is concerned about, given that this it's been on for so long? My imagination would be that it wouldn't be a problem in a lot of places, but given that it's, again, first past the post, there could be spaces where they get complacent and, you know, and lose the initiative.
Yeah, I mean, on postal voting, mail-in voting and voter ID, as Emily talked about, the Sadiq Khan campaign, which is the Labour London mayoral campaign, is openly and I would say tactically talking up the risk to Sadiq Khan from voter ID rules and the fact that it is a bit harder to vote than it used to be, and that will probably structurally disadvantage Labour because of the electorate that it's appealing to. Some of that probably is a real fear, but some of it is an anti-complacency message, actually. If you look at the polls in London, Labour is very well ahead. Sadiq Khan should win. But that was true last time as well. And although he did win, he didn't win by as much as the polls had originally suggested. The big difference, of course, is that last time Labour weren't doing particularly well nationally in the polls and the Tories were doing quite well. Mm-hmm. This time, the overall national picture is that the Tories are quite a long way behind Labour. And in a naturally Labour-leaning city, I mean, most cities are naturally Labour-leading, that's the nature of urban populations, you would expect that to be enough to carry them through. But they don't want people to be turned off voting. The other big fear that the London campaign has is that in previous London elections, the voting system has been that you could vote for your preferred party and then you had another vote for your second choice. And so quite a few people would vote Green or vote for the Lib Dems or vote for another party of the left or centre-left and then have the Labour candidate as their backup. That doesn't happen this time. It can't happen this time. And so Labour are a bit worried about that could let the Tories in through the middle. The Tories will come at least second. So the question is whether they come second or first. So that is a concern. There's a broader sort of issue around complacency in UK politics, which is that the polls have been showing a strong Labour lead for so long that nobody seriously expects them to lose at this point, even though the electoral mountain they've got to climb is still pretty big. On the last election, there are about 120 odd seats behind the Tories. So that's a huge number of gains. And the stat that I've probably said before, because it's so striking, is that to get a majority of one in the forthcoming general election, Labour would need to get the same level of Tory to Labour swing that Tony Blair got in 1997 when he got a majority of about 180. So although the polls are showing that Labour is set to win big, it does involve an enormous shift for that to happen, and no one is taking it for granted. I think one of the things that really guards against complacency within the Labour Party is that basically everyone who works for the Labour Party in any capacity, all of it, all the people running its campaigns, all of its staff, have so much experience of losing elections. They don't expect to win, so they don't believe it till they see it.
Right. There's also, and maybe this is just reading it from afar, but there's at least a media narrative around Keir Starmer that nobody is that enthused about him.
Yeah, I think that's right. He's not particularly personally popular, and people can trust him with, you know, Tony Blair in 1995-6-7, where he did score better on those sort of popularity ratings than Keir Starmer does. In one sense, that's true. In another sense, you only have to win the election you're in. And Rishi Sunak is also not particularly popular. There's a bit of a trade-off that Labour's recognition that it has an enormous mountain to climb and the fact that it has to appeal to a lot of voters who voted Conservative last time does mean that it is in some ways less radical than some people on the left would like it to be, because it's not trying to appeal to them so much as to sort of Tory Labour swing voters, who Labour calls them hero voters, which I always find a slightly embarrassing bit of jargon. But the hero voters are people who voted Tory last time and might vote Labour this time in the seats that Labour needs to win. And the basic fact of electoral campaigning is that those voters count double, because it's one vote off the Tory column and one vote on the Labour column.
I mean, this is the perpetual debate in the Democratic Party as well. Do you go after the young voter or the you know, the disaffected voter, the voter who hasn't bothered to come out because they don't think the political process is serving them? Or do you go after the moderate and try to pick them off the Republican? And in 2020, they had multiple segments where it was Republicans who weren't going to vote for Trump. They had Republican politicians talk about why they weren't going to vote for Trump. Like, it was definitely geared toward people who had voted Republican in the past and were appalled and couldn't bring themselves to do it again. And so, hey, why not vote for Biden? So the AOC message is, I know why people don't vote. It's that they don't think they're being served, and we need to reach those people.
And the classic proof point for that in UK politics in recent years is in the 2017 election, where Jeremy Corbyn did considerably better than Ed Miliband had done in the previous election only 2 years earlier. The Labour vote went up a lot, but what Labour didn't do at all effectively in that election was suppress the Tory vote, because they got a record turnout, a record vote as well. So, you know, it's, of course, you want to enthuse as many people as possible, but you want to suppress your opponent's vote and ideally draw them over to you. But a lot of the attacks on Starmer from the left are partly about trying to delegitimize the idea that he has done something special in getting a massive poll lead that previous Labour leaders haven't managed to do, particularly Corbyn, given the politics of the UK. If you read someone like Owen Jones, who's sort of a left-leaning Guardian columnist, he will say, look, Labour are going to win. They're going to win easily. The reason they're going to win easily is the Tories have messed everything up. It's all down to them. You know, a donkey with a red rosette would win for Labour at this point, so it doesn't really count. But it's also therefore safe to vote for left alternatives to Starmer, and that's a really dangerous message for Labour when they haven't won yet.
Look, as a person who's often critical of the let's just pick off Republicans line of the Democratic Party or of whoever, there's a sense in which listening to you, it's like, who cares that Corbyn got high turnout in 2017? He lost.
Well, exactly.
Almost doesn't count, right? Like, there's no prize for, like, it doesn't, what matters is, did you become prime minister?
Yeah. Well, there was a meme post-election in 2017 about Corbyn when he was, you know, he's at the Glastonbury Festival getting massive crowds to sing his name. And there were certain things that the Tories did where they dropped some policies or moderated some policies in a direction that Labour voters would be more favourable to. And there was this meme that went around that said, Jeremy Corbyn is the prime minister. And the big flaw in that is that he just wasn't.
Right. Look, I think that Biden definitely, on domestic policy, is left of where he would have been had Bernie not run and had Elizabeth Warren not run and had they not been pushing from the left. So it's not to say that they're like, I think there's tremendous function and importance of more left-wing politicians getting in the race and pushing policy and people, you know, sort of trying to draw their candidate toward more progressive policies. But I guess my response to Bernie would have won is, if Bernie would have won, Bernie would have won, right? And he didn't, so.
Yeah, I mean, and that's true of any losing candidate from any wing of any party where people say he was a better candidate. Well, he wasn't a better candidate. She wasn't a better candidate because, you know, we know that. One of the things I'm interested in, Rohan, is you've already talked about some of the more extreme rhetoric coming out of the BJP, possibly as a result of seeing the lower turnout, being a little bit concerned. Is there anything happening on the opposition side where people are feeling a bit more optimistic that they might do better than they thought, or is it all a one way thing?
We've spoken about this before, but I'll probably speak about it again. There's this term hava, which literally means wind, but refers here to the atmosphere that comes out of, or potentially to the momentum that you could take, sort of like a headwind or a tailwind going into something. And so parties across the board coming out of a phase of voting will seek to build that hava and to say that we have done better this time. And they look at, so the only data that you actually have is turnout data. And so they look at that. And of course, turnout data could be influenced by something as simple as the fact that, you know, a lot of North India was dealing with 40 degree weather, you know, 110, 120 degree weather, I guess, in America. And so it could be simply a result of that. But there was definitely the case that folks on the BJP side of things appear to be concerned and some even panicking in response. And narratives coming out of the opposition in particular places saying that we should be in place to benefit from this. Now, the turnout dropped across the board, including in places where the opposition was expecting to win. So in Tamil Nadu, for example, and it was up in some parts in West Bengal, for example. So it's a very hard thing to read, and studies by and large have shown it's conventional wisdom in India that high turnout numbers is an anti-incumbent message because people are coming out angry. This was upended by the 2019 election when people came out in bigger numbers but brought Modi back to power. So essentially, we don't know. But I think BJP folks think that lower turnout should affect them. And so you are seeing that. I mean, there's a lot more election to come still. But that is, I think, a bit more moderately the story coming out of the first phase. I think that takes us to a new segment that we're going to have at the end of our regular portion of the Election Tricycle, which we're calling Tricycle Recommends. And what we're going to do every week is just pick out one piece or interesting work on the elections that we'd like to point you guys to. So maybe we start off with Emily.
Well, this is not on the elections per se, but it is a tease for our next week's episode. So next week, we are going to be speaking about student protests. Obviously, this is a big story this week in the United States. It's a big story in India and elsewhere in the world as well. So this is a tease for that. And it's from Slate. It's what is really going on at Columbia University. And it sort of elegantly goes through the difference between mainstream media narratives and student reporting. And I think it's useful for thinking more generally about during fraught, heated moments, how narratives form and how that can be experienced differently than what's actually there and on the ground. Tom, what's yours?
I should say we'll put all these in the show notes. I'm going to recommend a really interesting Substack post by Steve Akerst in the UK on his Substack Strong Message Here, which is about getting to know Labour's new electoral coalition and just looking at some of the data behind the people who are voting Labour and what their attitudes are. There's two points that come out of it. One is that there's some quite interesting data that the Labour vote is fairly united around economic questions and quite disunited around sort of cultural questions, sort of social conservatism versus social liberalism. But looking beyond that, assuming Labour wins the election, some of the tensions that government faces, some of the problems it has to manage, will come out of what satisfying that coalition looks like. And having to deal with a voter base that is not united on some of these sort of what you might call culture wars questions that Labour has tried to stay out of, whereas some on the right have tried to sort of ferment, will be really interesting. I think there's a broader point as well that I think people have sort of lost track of a bit because it's so easy to forget, which is that whenever any party wins an election, it's their job to sort of service their entire electoral coalition and keep all of them happy. And the group of people that has been satisfied or potentially failed recently, but who the Tories were trying to satisfy from 2010 onwards, which includes the sort of the very safe bits of the Tory vote, as well as the more marginal bits, is just a totally different set of people from the set of people that Labour will be looking to look after. And I think that has potentially really interesting effects on what Labour does, how it gets covered, who is shouting and screaming about decisions that are made and who isn't in ways that haven't yet been sort of fully thought through. So it really is a really interesting piece that sort of made me think a lot about what the dynamics of a future Labour government might look like, just in terms of who they're trying to please. Rohan, what have you got to bring to us today?
I'll actually point to a book this week.
That's just showing off.
The book is called Love, Jihad and Other Fictions. I think I've mentioned it before on the podcast before, but Love, Jihad is this this right-wing narrative in India that virile young Muslim men are seducing the women of other communities, particularly Hindus, but also Christians in some parts of the country, and converting them into Islam that way. In its origin, not an abduction or even grooming sort of thing. It's just purely like they should not be allowed to seduce our women storyline. But it's gotten a lot of support and taken as real in a lot of India, including in court cases and so on. And so you have Maryam Elvi Supriya Sharma, who, full disclaimer, used to be a colleague of mine, and Srinivasan Jain, who put out a book and a bunch of very useful YouTube videos over the last few weeks and months, breaking down a number of these narratives that emerge from the right that have almost been taken as conventional wisdom in India, but often come out of really kooky right-wing theories. And yet, just because of the sheer media power and their ability to repeat it over and over again, have entered and remained in our popular culture in India.
All right. Well, we hope you all enjoyed that new segment as much as we enjoyed finding the pieces for it. And for our regular listeners, thanks for tuning in. We will talk to you next week. Premium listeners, stick around.
And if you want to be a premium listener, tricycle.hubwave.net.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@poddopods.com. podopods.com.